Welcome to Murder Most Foul, a podcast devoted to exploring famous murder cases of our time. Some solved, some unsolved, but all fascinating and guaranteed to raise the hairs on the back of your neck. I'm your host, Jim Solanowski. Today's episode... Finding Amy. It's every mother and father's worst nightmare to discover your daughter has vanished after a night on the town. Finding Amy is the story of just such a nightmare. Written by Detective Lieutenant Joseph K. Laughlin, who led the investigation into Amy St. Lawrence's disappearance, and his co-author, Kate Clark Flora. The story is especially compelling because of the personal accounts of Lieutenant Laughlin, his thoughts, emotions, and reactions as the investigation unfolded in 2001. Unlike Law and Order, or CSI, there were no quick solutions that wrapped up the case in a conveniently short time. What does take place is the passionate belief of the dedicated team of detectives and police that they will find Amy, bring her abductor to justice, and give closure to her family and the people of Maine. It is my pleasure to welcome Lieutenant Joseph Laughlin to Murder Most Foul.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Joe, before we enter the squad room and take out our notebooks, why don't you share with my listeners a little about time and place of this incident?
Yes, this happened in October 2001, right after 9/11. And if you remember, the two terrorists who flew into the Trade Center came from Portland first, Muhammad Atta and Alomari. So the city was already heightened right after that because we found the terrorist car there and all of the videos that they were involved. They spent like 2 weeks in Portland. So it takes place in Portland, Maine. I'm originally from New York, but I ended up in Portland, Maine. And Portland, Maine is a microcosm of any big city. It's the largest city north of Boston. It's gotten very complex as far as demographic changes. And for instance, in high school now, or even when I was there, it was at least 50, 60, 80 languages spoken in the downtown high school. So it's, again, a microcosm in a complex, city, a very vibrant, great city. So I was the commander of the detective division at the time, which is called the Detective Lieutenant. I had spent many years as a detective in various units, but now as a commander. So we had this report of a missing woman. Now, people go missing frequently all the time. People call in, and typically you find them within the first 24 hours or earlier. Drugs, alcohol, relationships, gambling, the whole list goes on, once you look into it. So in this case, I get a phone call on a Monday night. It's very busy. It's right after 9/11. The city was hyper-vigilant, and we have a lot of cases going on, typically in any detective division. So, I mean, it's humming all the time. And what happens is Sergeant Joyce calls me up, who's a very, very good investigator and a great leader of a Crimes Against People unit. And he says, hey, listen, we got this woman who's missing and stuff. And I'm going, oh, come on, because I got to send people in on overtime. And I said, Tom, I don't think I can do it right now, And he goes, well, I'm telling you right now, this is the lieutenant. So when he calls me lieutenant instead of Joe, because we've known each other, we worked together for years. I knew all these people. And he said, this looks like the real deal. Danny Young got it from a sheriff over in Cumberland County. He said, this woman's really missing because the sheriff, deputy knew the family, called city police, and then we get involved. I'm like, all right, why don't you and Dan go in? They go in and they go in like at 7 at night and they spend the whole night there. They probably get home at 4 in the morning, or they probably just stayed right up. So the next morning they come into my office first thing and they said, listen, this girl's name is Amy St. Laurent and she departed so dramatically from her behavior and what she would consistently do on a daily basis. And it's the real deal. She's missing. Before I proceed, is that I want to acknowledge Kate Clark-Flora again, because this took years to write, and it's amazing how I accomplished this and to see the book. So my goal was to impart reality. You know, I'll make a general statement, is that people have very little realistic information about what police officers and detectives do on a day-to-day basis. It's not the movies, it's not TV. Real life is dirty, grotesque, disturbing, and it's permanent. So what happens is we find out that Amy St. Laurent was with a man named Eric Rubright, and he had design on her. He was interested in her. She met him in Florida on a trip. And he says, hey, I want to come up to Maine and visit Maine. She goes, oh, sure. But she made it clear that she wasn't interested. She had just broken up with her boyfriend at the time, Richard Sparrow. So she was very definitive about not crossing any lines with him. So they went to Boston to see Boston. And on the way back, she goes, hey, let's go to the Old Port. And the Old Port is a, you know, entertainment district in our city. Has a lot of bars, restaurants, nightclubs, and all of that. Before they go to the nightclub where she ended up missing from, they go to a bar called the Iguana. And they play pool, and a couple of other bars they went to. There were three men in that bar that played pool with them, one of which ultimately turned out to be the killer. We didn't know that at the time, of course. So they go up to the Pavilion Nightclub, which is a big dance club, and Eric does not dance. So these other guys come in, and the primary suspect, again, we didn't know, asked her to dance, so she danced with him. He's a slick guy. He's been, you know, a predator on women down the Old Port for a long time. He's a sexual offender. We don't know that at the time either. So during the nightclub, it's Eric goes to the bathroom. The nightclub, the lights come on. She can't find him. He can't find her. So this guy, Jeffrey Russell Gorman, says, why don't you come to us with us and we'll go to my friend's house. And she would never, ever do that. And here's where we think that he put Rohypnol on a drink, because we tracked down a lot of women later during the investigation that had sex with him and were ashamed about it because they were definitely drugged with GHB, Rohypnol, or whatever. We developed a pattern on him and a suspect behavior and post-offense behavior and all that. So he brings her to this unquote party that never manifests.
If I'm not mistaken, she was also kind of stranded there without the gentleman she came with, because all her stuff, her purse and stuff, was in his car. And I understand all she had with her was her ID.
At the time, all she had was her driver's license. And she was, you know, she would never, ever, based on her past behavior, leave with someone. She has good intuition. She's a good background. She's a good young lady, and everything attend to that. She kind of trusted this guy temporarily. But when she gets to the place, her intuition kicks in. And she's like going, something's wrong here. Take me back. And that's where she never comes back. Now, he tells us, once we start going through the labyrinth of interviewing all these people, which is protracted again, he tells us that, you know, oh, yeah, she wanted to go back, so I dropped her off, you know, at the Pavilion nightclub at 1:45 in the morning. So the second day, the first 24 hours, we're focused on the guy, Eric, because Eric has her backpack, her phone. What he did that night was we ended up OnStarring his car. There's no GPS and stuff back then. So we're going with real fundamental, you know, ground-pounding investigation. So the detectives say, we got to find this guy that brought her to the nightclub, that she brought to the nightclub. And they determine his name. They do an OnStar on the car that he rented. They find it down in the Old Port. And they go put some cops on that. And he comes back to the car, and they stop him, and they say, hey, would you come to the station voluntarily? And at this time, Amy's picture, Amy St. Laurent, is her picture. Posters are all over the city. I'm talking like first the next day after the first night, all over the city, everywhere. And the family's invested, and the tension is ratcheting up. And then police chief, my chief Chitwood gets involved. We get involved. In the meantime, there's all this investigation going on. So Rube Wright decides to come into the police station, but he's acting, you know, in what we would say post-offense behavior. He has all our stuff. He comes up with a convoluted story of what he did to get home. He goes to her house, which is South Borough, and he doesn't sleep there, which is strange because he slept there the night before. So that's like, why wouldn't you sleep in a house, you know? Or why wouldn't you wait for the girl to come home? Where is she? So he sleeps in his car, gets up the next day, takes a shower, which, again, post-offense behavior, you know, cleaning yourself off. And he writes a note, and he leaves. Then we find him that night down in the Old Port. He comes in, again, voluntarily. He's not under arrest. We don't read a Miranda or anything at that point. And so he's in an interview room, and we go through the whole process. His story doesn't make sense. And then we said, would you be willing to take a polygraph? And he goes, sure. So that's a good thing, you know? So he decides to take a polygraph. One of my good friends, co-workers, comes in. He's a polygraph operator at the time. It's different than what it is now. And what happens is he fails on a lot of points. We also find out that he has criminal history. He has a restraining order against him for a woman named Amy down in Florida, and a couple of other things that don't make sense. So now we're focused on him. Personally, based on my experience and everything I had learned, and a whole group of detectives were going like, oh my God, we got the guy. We're catching him in a lot of lies, a lot of manipulation. His body language is off. Everything that you would think of as someone who's, you know, guilty of something, based on our, you know, behavioral applications and all the other things. Later on that night, I started work early in the morning, and it probably was 8 o'clock at night. They had brought in all these other guys that the night before, the three guys that were with her and with Eric. By the way, it was only Gorman that took her back to the house. And then we have to go to that house and interview everybody there in the investigation. So, you know, we're talking about, okay, this guy's going to leave tomorrow. Let's do a search warrant in his car. He consents to that. He fails a polygraph. He starts telling us, yeah, I lied about that and this. And then we're thinking, oh, it's got to be the guy. Now, Danny Young, who's a gumshoe, you know, astute detective that just doesn't give up. He's unbelievable. So ultimately, by the end of the night, we make Danny the primary detective, who is just going to be the focus and the funnel of this case. But Danny comes up to me and goes, I don't know, Lieutenant, and I can't eliminate this guy, Jeffrey Gorman. And we go, I don't know, Dan, we got the guy. He goes, he's the last one that was with her. We finally eliminate Rubra, and we say it can't be him. Now we're looking at Gorman. And the first lie that Danny catches him in, he comes back in for a second interview. Very arrogant. He doesn't want to cooperate fully. He's feigning cooperation, you know, which is, he has extensive criminal history, restraining orders, warrants, probation, terrible juvenile record. And so that's indicative, and he's very, very familiar with dealing with police. And he's sort of, I'd say psychopathic more than sociopath. This guy was not nervous at all. And we got videotapes, and I can send you some pictures of that and stuff, of him being interviewed, and he's doing all the body language, body posturing, and he's very arrogant in his interviews about dropping her off and how he was concerned with her and how he, when he dropped her off at the nightclub, he said, oh, yeah, there were a whole bunch of people there. That was a flag right away. At that time of night, there's nobody there because The cops come in and sweep the area. Street cops come in, sweep the area, the bounces, because there have been so many fights there and some weapons calls and all that stuff that happens after a nightclub closes. So we know at like 1:15 the place is empty and there's nobody on the street. He says he drops her off like 1:45, something like that, and he sees her walking towards the entrance. He says, well, I felt bad that I left her, and I went back home. It took me about 10, 15 minutes to get home. So the next day, Danny Young, who's now the primary, starts enlisting some other detectives. They start pulling cameras in the area. They don't see anything relative to him dropping her off. There's the first lie that we can definitively, on our what they call a murder board now, timeline. So you'll have a room with poster up, and you'll do a timeline of events of when she went missing. Then we go to the apartment. The officers go to the apartment and start interviewing people who say, yeah, he came home 20 minutes and stuff. But after some investigation, that never happened. They were lying for him. And he is seen in the bathroom by another roommate, like around 4 a.m. in the morning, cleaning up. And I think that the guy, I think his name was Matt, who saw him cleaning up in the bathroom, saw some blood spatter or something on his leg. Now, his girlfriend at the time, he had a girlfriend at the time, and she didn't know if this guy was running around like a lunatic. She saw blood on his jeans, too, the next day. And he goes, oh, he made up the story like, Mary's friend had puppies, and I was helping her with the puppies, or something like ridiculous. So now it's starting to catch him in lies. He comes back in again to the station for a subsequent interview, as other people do too, and we're slowly, methodically eliminating people like, okay, here's our focus. And now I'm convinced, okay, this is the guy, but where's the girl? We got to find out where she is. And how do we put a case together with, again, no body, no crime scene, no place to begin? So we're going to begin with her and her victimology and study her life, and then we're going to begin with him. We already have him in a couple of lies, and it gets even more exciting as we go along here. So you have a big geographic area to search. So now we're appealing to everybody in the state's invested. It starts becoming national news. We do a press conference almost every day. I meet with the mother, the parents, and we go through all of that. Diane Jenkins, who's the amazing woman. Now we got to enlist the state police because it's not our jurisdiction. So this is when, well, it's almost like sports teams. Like, our detective is way better than yours. You and that, they think the same thing. It's really like sports teams, like football team, baseball team. So now we're like reluctant. We don't want to yield this case, but we have to because the state police have jurisdiction of any homicides outside the city. And we coordinate an effort to do a search warrant of her house, a consent search with the mother present. And, it was horrible for them because she's smelling her clothes and, you know, you really vicariously, you get attached to victims and people suffering, and you can, it's just a terrible thing. Anyhow, so now we got a search warrant at the house. We searched the house, again, consent search. The mother is involved. We got the family involved. They're on the news every night. You know, everybody from Boston to NPR is calling up, and it's getting really heated. And now we got to, you know, we're focused on the suspect, but we're doing multiple searches from every possible angle we can. So we got a large geographic area from Portland down to Berwick. And so we're doing water searches, we're doing air searches, we're doing patrol searches, different teams. We got every day, and everybody's invested in this. The city and the surrounding police departments are invested. So what happens is, next is, we're studying Gorman, and he's making statements to people that even people are starting to alert around him. And one guy said, they were talking about Amy missing. He goes, yeah, if I killed that girl, I dumped her over by the marine terminal, you know, which is on the water. And so he tells us that because he knows something's wrong. He knows this guy had something to do with it. Here's another fascinating thing. He had a shitbox car. And people would get into it and be garbage all over and everything. That's the car he transported Amy. We know that she was in that car. And the following day, it was cleaned. It was immaculate. It was washed. It was detailed. And so that is like, okay, we want to see that car. Because if something happened in the car, you'd be amazed how much blood spatter can travel up inside things. And we want a search warrant on that car. He wouldn't let us do a search warrant. He tells us a lie about dropping her off. He says, you can't look in my car. Well, what about taking a polygraph? Well, I don't want to take a polygraph. I don't trust him. You know, the total opposite of many other people and Eric Rubride. So now he's doing a lot of post-offense behavior. And as it moves on, this is very interesting too, from suspect behavior of homicide, is he starts changing his features. He shaves his head. He gets tattoos. He's starting to spiral into a different area, and some of his unquote friends ultimately come out saying, this doesn't make sense. Were you connected to her anyway? Yeah, I was with this guy and that guy, and we saw her. I called her parents up, and it goes on and on. But now we're starting to catch some really good facts, again, facts and circumstances that would lead a reasonable person to believe, like, okay, this is true. How do we test the veracity of that? And it goes on from there. So we have to get a search warrant for the car. So we get a search warrant for the car. I'm saying, we're going to get something in that car. And we didn't get anything. Then we go to the apartment to do a search warrant in the apartment to see if there's any clothing or any other type of evidential material. Plus, some of his roommates said, yeah, I saw him when he came back about 20 minutes later. And I was online sending emails. Well, now we want to see that computer. He voluntarily gives it to us. And at the time, you know, computer forensics were pretty limited, but he never sent any emails. And there are multiple layers of stories like that where we're finding the roommates in compromising situations, too.
If I can interject here, a gun is going to feature prominently in the case, in the resolution. How does Gorman get a gun?
So we found out his best friend was this guy named Ryan Campbell. He was a piece of crap. And he was a part-time deputy. You know, one of those summer deputies down in Old Orchard Beach. We don't do that in my city. And his gun went missing. So we're kind of alerted on that. And he said the night that Gorman took this woman from the nightclub back to Brighton Avenue. So we're thinking, okay, he probably went to Ryan Campbell's house, which he hung out all the time. He used to bring girls back there all the time. And then he has to come back from Westbrook over back to Brighton Avenue where this guy Matt sees him at 4 a.m. cleaning up. So now we're starting to piece together, okay, a closer geographic area. Then we find out his mother lives in proximity to the city, just on the over the city line by a farm in Scarborough, in the woods. And we know that, you know, he's been living with his mother. So now we find that, and I go, oh, maybe he brought her into the woods and did something. We don't know anything. We know nothing. So now that we have the state police involved, we got to get another primary detective. So we get Scott Harakles, a great detective enlisted with Danny Young. And, you know, there's that initial, like, who are you tension type, like dogs, like sizing each other up. And man, they glued together and they were so invested once they learned about Amy and who she was and her family. They got really emotionally invested. And in fact, as we're going along, you know, I'd say, what about this? What about that? And they go, our Amy, which I never heard before, our Amy wouldn't do that. Let's get the Coast Guard involved. Let's get the Maine State Police dive team involved. Get them over to Merrill Transport to do the, let's get, you know, I went, there was a guy who came in and said, I'll volunteer my helicopter to do searches, right? So we did some searches over the area where Gorman lived and his mother. And his mother came out. When people see a helicopter that low and that close, they usually wave. Well, she doesn't wave. And she's like, okay, that doesn't look right. we get a phone call from the Maine Warden Service. And the Maine Warden Service talks to the state police. They're part of the state police, state government. And then they tell me to call this guy up, Pat Dorian. And I go, well, what are these guys going to do? This is a city. They're not. And they go, yeah, but it could be outside. I go, you got a point. So he calls me up on the phone. He goes, listen, we think we can help you. We think she's got to be in a certain geographical area because we go search and rescue all the time for missing persons in the woods, dead bodies in the woods, murder cases and stuff like that. So they come down, and it was fascinating. So if they're walking through the woods, you know, we're in buildings all the time and dirty apartments and stuff, and you can see things where they can't see. And when they're in the woods, they go, stop, stop. We go, what? See that spider web there? See that broken branch? You see that? So they see things. Anyhow, so we all get together, and there's multiple layers to this. So we're coming down into, now she's missing almost 3 months. Now we're into December. And if she is buried and she's in the woods in proximity to her mother's house, we got to get out there because if it snows, it's going to, you know, limit the dog's ability. And then we got frozen ice on top of it. So all those things are happening. So maybe about a week before we're going to do this big search with the state police, tons of detectives, search and rescue, helicopters, the Maine Warden Service, and it goes on. So one night, I'm in the office late, as always. Well, you literally slept in the office sometimes. I roll up my leather jacket, and I tell Tommy, I go, wake me up at 5 before the chief gets in. I mean, it's just, it takes your whole life, and a lot of cases do. So Danny comes in, and he goes, I got to tell you something, Lieutenant. I can't believe I didn't do it earlier. I did a preliminary National Crime Index search, you know, because you can plug in someone's name into the NCIC. Now it's a lot easier. And it'll tell you if that person's been stopped by the DMV, because every police stop, you know, you have to catalog it and log it down. Now everything's videotaped. So we find out, this is amazing. He goes, you're not going to believe this. Gorman was stopped in Westbrook at 3:45 in the morning. And I'm going, oh my, I mean, it was such an amazing moment. I go, what do you mean, Dan? Now we're like, okay, so you got Brighton Avenue over here. It's almost like a triangle. So the nightclub down here, this guy's house over here, the mother's house here. We're building up a small triangular area and almost a box of where she has to be. So now we got that traffic stop. So now we got the timeline that he never dropped her off. He was over at Campbell's house, I'm sure. I think we did a search warrant to that house to look for the gun. We probably got consent. Then he went back to Brighton Avenue 4 in the morning. So his timeline that he told us is way off. So now we're getting some real good meat.
And you also set up a ruse in an attempt to drive Gorman, or actually try to get him to show you where the body was.
We took two undercover female state troopers, put them in the store like they were shopping, and they were like talking about, hey, did you hear they think they found that girl? And we had put it, what they call at the time, a bird dog on his car, which is a radio frequency. Now you can do a GPS slap and everything like that. You got to get a search warrant for it. But at that time, you, if it's in a public place, you can put a bird dog, which is a little square device, a magnet that goes up underneath the car, and you have to be close to it to get a radio frequency pickup. So after he's in the store and he's trying to talk to these two undercover state females, they start talking, you know, peripherally about a potential of a body being found over in the woods, and which we're thinking, okay, he's going to go to the body. So we got the bird dog on him, so now we're trying to follow him by radio frequency, and he goes to his mother's house, you know, and stays there. So conjecture and speculation, and in the end, turned out to be true. He went to his mother's house, but he went out the back door and around and into the woods where he had killed her and ultimately buried her. We didn't know this at the time. So that's why he left his mother's, never left his mother's house. We decide on December 8th, now she went missing, I think, on October 20th, mm-hmm. on December 8th to do a massive search, a coordinated search with multiple teams that had canines, state police, fixed-wing helicopters, and everything you can think of, and detectives. And they would be assigned to a geographic area to slowly go through the woods in a grid search, and there was a warden with each group. So there was usually a Portland detective, a warden, a state police detective, and someone from search and rescue.
As you're preparing for this major search, where's Gorman?
So he's on probation. And when you're on probation, you can't leave the state. So maybe a week before that, sometime around that time, because things in the media are heating up. And, you know, we released some of the lies that he said. We said we have a person of interest, a potential suspect, which is him, and he knows it. And now he's making crazy statements to his friends. And so he wants to leave the state. Now, we know this. If someone's on probation and you know, you have to report it to the probation officer that this guy can't leave the state. It's illegal. So all of us get in a room, the detectives, and I go, Tom, if we let him go out of state and he hurts someone, which he almost did, yeah, it's going to be us. It's going to be me and the chief. We'll be sued and we'll be, you know, who knows what'll happen. And he goes, well, do you want this guy? Because once he gets out of the city, he's going to start talking. So he goes back to where he was raised in Troy, Alabama. As this whole search thing is starting to heat up and everything, and we're telling the media we're going to do a massive search, and he's in Troy, Alabama. Now, his surrogate mother's down there. He's very close with, you know. So he confesses to her, I killed that girl up in Maine, right? He also is ratcheting up in his behavior. You know, he's starting to, like, he's got a gun with him now. He's, you know, he's got all the stuff that's happened. So he's down there. We let him go, praying that nothing happens. What happens the day of the search, we get all of this coordinated effort with the wardens being the primary people that are going to segregate where the search quadrants are going to be. You know, I'm going around checking on different teams. The other supervisors are, you got anything? And I'm going, there's no way, no way we're going to find this girl. And you start giving up hope. And Danny Young said to me, he goes, no, I think we're going to find her. I go, how, Danny? He goes, I just have that feeling. And your intuition, your gut feelings as a detective is usually right. So it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm going to get back to Detective Thorpe. You know, he's one of the naysayers. He's with a team, and they step on, all of a sudden, they're doing a grid search. You know, they're arm's length away from each other and going through their area. You comb in the area, look at it, and all of a sudden, the earth is soft. He goes, that doesn't feel right. And they look down, and they see fresh pine needles sticking up out of the ground. He goes, I know my buildings. I know crime scenes, but that's not right. Well, the dogs come out, and they go nuts. And they go nuts on two places. And they go to a tree, a pine tree, and they're really moving around that pine tree like crazy. And then they go back to where there ultimately is a grave. So the canine guys go, you know, she probably was laying here for a long time. And then he came back and buried her later on. So we got two crime scenes here. So now, you know, the dog's alert. So now they call me and Danny's there. And all he goes, I think this is it. I think we found it. You can't describe the emotion or feel. I mean, you feel like crying. It's almost like even now it's coming back. And I know when we talk about it sometimes, it comes back to you. So Danny's there. We call in Scott Heracles. We call in Matt Stewart. We call in Tommy Joyce. Everybody's there. And now we got a big crime scene, but you can't let people into it. You know, you got to isolate it and have one track going in and one track going out. So we know the rest of the earth is not disturbed. The initial place where she was laying is not disturbed. So we can do a forensic dig. Danny goes in to the roped off area and digs down. Now imagine this. He is a primary detective that girl is in his heart and soul, and Scott Heracles is behind him. And Danny digs down with a trowel and boom, hits something. And it's her. And he starts digging a hole with his hands and then sees the gray sweatshirt that she was wearing last seen in. And he goes, oh my God, it's her. And you know, he gets back up and gets emotional. Imagine touching the And what Gorman had done is he assaulted her in the car, we know at the end. He got the wrong girl. He tried to put the moves on her, assault her in the car. Punched her in the face, knocked a tooth out, broke a couple of bones in her face, put a gun to her, and she was resisting it. He drives out to this road near his mother's house, about 200 yards from the mother's house. Brings her out there, tries to rape her. We have her underwear down in the autopsy, down by her ankles, and ultimately shoots her in the head. We don't know any of this at the time. And then he goes, oh, what am I going to do now? Drags her into the woods. And here's an interesting piece that at night, when you're dragging something around the woods, you think it'd go much further than you do, actually. So it wasn't that far from this little dirt road. Leaves her there. The next day he, you know, wakes up and goes, I got to bury her because some animals will get her or some hunters will see her or something like that. So he goes back, digs a hole, puts her in it and puts a cement form over her. You know the cement forms that they go at the bottom of, like when they're putting a foundation up? It's basically a big piece of heavy wood. Puts that over her and then buries her. She's under there. Now it's getting dark, it's cold out, and it's going to snow. And if we got to get her out before it snows. So the protracted, extended nature of this crime scene goes on for hours. You got to videotape everything, document everything, every dig. And so the two medical examiners come in and do a forensic dig piece by piece. It goes on for hours. And now it's, I don't know what time of night. I don't know. I'm just thinking maybe 11 at night. And we've been up for days. And Danny Young and Scott Heracles are there. And we're all around a big circle. And, you know, there's the glow of the lights and the hum of the generators, and they're all, everybody's kind of hugging each other as we're taking out of the body. I mean, it was extremely emotional. Now we have the body. We don't know how she was killed. Finally, I go home and get a couple hours sleep, and those guys went up for the autopsy in the morning of the following day, like 4 and 4, and they didn't sleep at all. And so Tommy Joyce, he's a supervisor sergeant, calls me up and he goes, okay, we just got done with the autopsy. And I go, oh my God, how? And I thought she was strangled or something. He goes, gunshot to the head. And I'm going, gunshot to the head? Oh God, no. And I go, well, what else we got? He says, dude, the DNA, do we do? He goes, we did everything. We don't know yet. We got to do this. And her underwear was down by her ankles. And he goes through the rest of the lurid details I'm not going to give you, but it was intense.
At this point, someone, of course, must notify the next of kin. And I believe this did fall to you, didn't it?
That night, once we found her, I called up Diane, who I had developed a very good relationship with, and her good friend, Lucille Holt. And so she starts crying, I'm tearing up and everything. And I said, we don't tell anybody yet, Diane, because the news is here. We don't want to let them know yet. I don't want to create a crescendo of chaos. We want to be very methodical about this. She goes, can I call Dennis, the father? She goes, yes. So now Dennis comes to the crime scene. So I go down to the main street, and there he is, and he wants to go up there. And, you know, when you're dealing with people in crisis, you know, at crime scene, they want to, they'll push through you, they'll fight you. He didn't do that. I had a good relationship with him, and he goes, I just want to go. I go, Dennis, you can't. It's so important that we do this right so we can put this guy away. I need you to be strong and cooperative. Call Diane up. Call your daughter up. The poor sister. I mean, it's just, it's all starting to come back to me. It's just watching these people suffer is just brutal. And watching detectives suffer, too, is brutal, too. These are things that people don't know in real life. It's the emotions that are, that just will kill you. So, so we told the mother, and I think we floated in the news the next morning with the chief doing a press. Actually, no, the chief went out that night and did a press conference that we had found a grave. Yeah, so now the news, it's all, they found the girl, blah, blah, blah. They think it's a girl. They're not sure. So in the meantime, Gorman, now he hears on the news that we found this woman. So now he's going to go and spin dry. And he does. So he's ratcheted up. He already confessed to the surrogate mother down there. I can't remember her name. He called his mother up sometime in between us, and he goes, "Mom, I killed that girl. When I did, I saw your face." He hated his mother. So he went to a sandwich shop during the day down in Troy, had a gun on him, and some guy was looking at him. And he goes, "What the F are you looking at? What's your F?" I mean, he's like, he's ratcheted up. Pulls a gun out, points it at the guy, and the guy says, "What are you going to do, kill me?" And there's some exchange like that. Guy calls the cops, Gorman takes off, goes to his friend's house. Cops come, they track Gorman down to the friend's house, and now there's a barricaded subject. He's doing a standoff with the gun to his head in the window and all this crazy stuff and that people do. It's not uncommon. And so now they got to call a SWAT team, and they negotiate with him for at least 4 hours. He comes out, they got him. Now, Danny Young and Scott Harakles want to interview him right away before he gets pulled into probation. They drive all the way down there because Scott didn't want to fly. He had a bad experience. I mean, it just doesn't stop. It's just, you know, and everybody in the media, they found the girl. They found, it's just the beginning for us of a whole other, you know, series of this case. So the next step was a grand jury indictment where the officers laid out all the detectives laid out all the information, and they interviewed other people subsequent to that. Secret proceedings, as you know, and then there is an indictment. Now, during the grand jury testimony, Tammy Westbrook, the mother of Gorman, is in grand jury and testifies that, you know, yes, he called me up and he said he killed her. And shot her in the head and gave all the details and said, "You're lucky it wasn't you, Mom." So that's in. That's huge. Plus we have Mary Young and the surrogate mother she was so crazy we couldn't even put her on a stand. But that was part of the grand jury too. So when we finally go to trial, and you know, at the trial, you got the poor family's got to be there, you know, the sister's there. And Gorman comes in, he's got his head shaved, but he would turn around and look at the family. You know what I mean? And it's just like, he's a psychopath. But I mean, and the poor sister's running out in the hallway crying. I mean, the guy's a monster. He'd stare at the family and everything. And you just want to jump up and smack the guy. You know what I mean? It's just so visceral. But it just shows you what he's like, you know, even at trial. Maintaining his innocence stuff. You know, but then the mother gets on the stand during the trial, and she has an attorney, Dan Lilly, and she says, "I don't remember anything. I'm traumatized by this whole thing, that my son is involved in this. I don't think he is." And so she loses her memory. And fortunately, we have a video, an audio tape of her speaking in grand jury. However, that's protected. Now, there are some federal and state cases, and it depends upon the application, if it's been adjudicated by the Supreme Court in the state and our Supreme Court in the country. The judge has to make a serious decision because it could all come back on her, and she was very good, that to make the grand jury tape admissible as evidence in the courtroom in front of everybody to play it back. And she invoked a couple of, I don't have in front of me, a couple of cases, Supreme Court cases. And that was a powerful moment. So being able to be in that courtroom and hearing the mother on tape at grand jury talking about it was a wow. And the jury, the pressure on them is enormous. It's enormous because they're talking about someone's life here. But we know that this guy or this gal is a killer or a rapist or whatever, pedophile or whatever. As I would go in and out of the courtroom, go over and visit stuff, and I'm just, you know, you can see the tension on the jury, but fortunately, this jury, again, it was a circumstantial case because there's a lot of things that weren't allowed to be introduced into evidence. For instance, there's no gun or the lower details of the body and crime scene. So a lot of things the jury never heard, but there was enough circumstantial evidence, the body, the proximity of the body, the confessions, the mother's confession, all the other things about his timeline and everything that added up. That was presented properly by the prosecutor. And one of the most harrowing parts of a trial is the jury's coming back. They're deliberating. They're coming back now. So you're running down a hall to get in there. And, you know, we're in the halls pacing around for hours. And it's, you know, you're just so worried that this guy's going to get out, you know, and harm other people. Because in my mind, this guy is a sexual serial offender, and that was his first homicide that we know of. So if he killed somebody and he's been, you know, dating all these women, dropping drugs into their drinks and having sex with them, he's going to kill again if he gets out. So fortunately, the jury comes back and it was guilty, and so almost like you almost could fall down. I can see Danny Young and Scott hugging each other and his tears in everybody's eyes. It's amazing. Diane Jenkins created the Amy St. Laurent Foundation, which helps women, educate women about serial sexual offenders, and how to protect yourself. And it invests in what we call the Rape Aggression Defense Program, sponsored by Portland Police and many police departments across the country. And you women come in and they learn the basics and the fundamentals of self-defense, and how to handle the adrenaline rushes and what to do in cases where someone is trying to attack you, or, you know, education about don't leave your drinks unattended. That's one of the things I always tell women, do not leave your drink unattended. Learn defense programs and be aware when you're walking around. But it would behoove any young lady or any man for that instance to take one of these programs or a similar program like it so you can function under duress if you get in a circumstance like that.
So, Joe, this case was almost a quarter of a century ago, and I've sat with you today, and I can see it still affects you. Why don't I give you a few moments just to sort of wrap up?
I can feel it. I can feel the emotion still when I'm, or I can visualize it, like when I'm talking about the detectives and all of us surrounding the grave, if we're doing an exhumation. I mean, it just comes back to you. You can feel it. And stuff I haven't thought about in a long time. But I'm so proud of the work that the detectives do and detectives do every day and police officers do every day. And again, you know, police officers operate and function in a world that goes far beyond the realm of normal experiences and what they see in one day alone. One of my primary goals is to educate people about the realities of police work and realities of investigations and the care and wellness of officers and their souls, because this work can break your soul, and I haven't experienced that myself. And it's also very difficult on families, relationships, and all of those things. So my takeaway also is the fact that it seems, and thanks to you, that this story is coming out again. A lot of young people are interested in true crime and the realities thereof. So that's great. And I also want to direct you to Kate Clark Flora again, because she's just published a couple more books. It's amazing. And personally, I'll never do nonfiction again. It just takes forever. So I'm working on a romance novel now, by the way. So I hope this opens the eyes of and ears of a lot of people.
To my listeners. I hope you found today's segment interesting and informative. Sexual assault is on the rise in this country, and it is up to all of us to educate ourselves on the issue. Information on the Amy St. Laurent Foundation can be found at their website, which is amystlaurentfoundation.org. No caps, no spaces. Laurent is L-A-U-R-E-N-T. Captain Laughlin can be reached through his website, which is josephlaughlin.com. And that's Laughlin, L-O-U-G-H-L-I-N. I hope you will tell your friends about today's episode of Murder Most Foul. Information and a link to all 100 episodes can be found at the podcast's website, along with an email link that will get a message to me. Your feedback is always appreciated. The address is www.murdermostfoul, all one word, no caps, no spaces, .com. So, until we meet again, stay safe. And for God's sakes, don't murder anyone.